Operation Mind Control by Walter H. Boart. Researchers, 3rd edition, published by special arrangement with Freedom of Thought Foundation, copyright 2002 by Walter H. Boart, revised expanded 2nd edition, copyright 1994 by Walter H. Boart, 1st edition published by Dell Publishing Company, 1978. This book is dedicated to those who are obedient to authority. May they follow in the path of Daniel Ellsberg, L. Fletcher Prouty, Victor Marchetti, George O'Toole, and others. Become responsible and break free from the chains of command. And this book is especially dedicated to the survivors of Operation Mind Control. I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of society but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. Thomas Jefferson. In the technotronic society, the trend would seem to be towards the aggregation of the individual support of millions of uncoordinated citizens, easily within the reach of magnetic and attractive personalities, effectively exploiting the latest communication techniques to manipulate emotions and control reason. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor. Only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity. Marshall McLuhan. If the minds of the people are impure, their land is also impure. But if their minds are pure, so is their land. There are not two lands, pure or impure, in themselves. The difference lies solely in the good or evil of our minds. Nisharan Dashwin. Author's note. This book is an exercise in citizens' intelligence. The author and the majority of those who have contributed to it are private citizens working on their own in a synergistic effort without major funding or corporate support, without government privilege or need to know, other than the need cited by Jefferson, the need for informed discretion in democracy. Without the help of these many people, who, like the author, were motivated by shock and outrage that citizens have been so victimized by their own government, this book would not have been undertaken. Thanks first to the victims of mind control who had the courage to come forward and tell their stories. Since this book first came out, I have interviewed hundreds more of the mind control victims. Alas, while adding much to the content of my files, few have shed any new light on the processes involved. A number of professional people gave valuable technical assistance and patient explanations. My thanks to Harry Ahrens, Robert Berners, Dr. and Mrs. Sidney M. Cohen, Dr. Remo DeCenso, Betty Dumain, Dr. Milton Erickson, Morris Ernst, Bernard Fursterwald, George Griffin, Colonel Laird Gutterson, Dr. Paul Henshaw, Edward Hunter, Honorable Louis K. Lukoszewicz, John McDonald, Dr. Colin Ross, V.R. Sanchez, Alan Shefflin, Dr. Edward Schein, Mrs. E.D. Yeomans, and Colonel Joseph A. Zieglinski. I received a great deal of assistance from a number of researchers and writers around the world. Thanks to Nancy Bressler, Martin Cannon, Jeff Cohen, Lauren Coleman, Richard Crow, Dave Emery, Francis Fox, Harlan Girard, William Grimstead, Paul Koch, Rita Hill, L. Ron Hubbard, Larry Lee, Charles Masterson, John Marks, David McQueen, Sandra Merkdoff, Janet Michard, Beverly Ogden, George O'Toole, Richard Popkin, Dick Russell, Jeff Kiros, William Stevenson, Scoop Sweeney, Cynthia Walsh, Harold Weisberg, David Williams, and Peter Watson, and many others who wish to remain anonymous. Mae Russell kept in contact with me from the time this book was originally released until her untimely death. She illuminated my understanding on Project Paperclip, the cryptocracy's illegal importation of Nazis into the U.S. intelligence systems after World War II, and called my attention to the circumstances of the probable programming of the assassin of John Lennon and the attempted assassins of Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. Other valuable assistance was given by the following institutions and organizations: the Rare Books and Special Collections Division of Princeton University Library, Brain Mind Bulletin, Zodiac News Service, Freedom News Service, Pacific News Service, the Fifth Estate, Network Against Psychiatric Assault, the Assassination Information Bureau, American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, Sanity Now, Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis, Center for National Security Studies, Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry, and the National Technical Information Service. Anthony Robbins and the staff of Robbins Research Institute trained me in neurolinguistic programming and struck me with all sorts of adventures until I earned my NLP professional certification, finally understanding what Milton Erickson had been trying to get me to understand in 1976. NLP was a big eureka for me. I saw it as the basis of what might be called a form of opposite to mind control, mind self-control. My understanding of the intelligence community was molded by exchanges with a number of intelligence and military people. They shall remain nameless. Special overt thanks to Colonel Fletcher Prouty, Michael Kratz, and Alan Bell of Dektor Counterintelligence and Security, who trained me in the use of psychological stress evaluation, and Carl F. Bood of Desert Security, who made his equipment available to me to examine the stress patterns of those I interviewed. Tom Miller gave me much of his time and expertise as Citizens Counterintelligence Agent Extraordinaire. His interest in the subject never waned, and research for his own The Assassination Please Almanac, 1977, Contemporary Books, uncovered leads for the first volume. Kudos to Joanna Moore Grinek, Martha Sowertwine, and my late mother, Fenna, for their patience and support. Between the first edition and this one, 16 years have passed. My thanks go to all those who kept demanding that this book be brought back into print. It was the original demand which drove the price of the original paperback to a remarkable $100 per copy, and finally overcame the resistance to this edition. In 1999, a copy of the original paperback of Operation Mind Control sold for $800. My special gratitude goes to Tom Davis, who kept this book alive for researchers and scholars in a photographic edition and paid honest royalties on each copy sold, and to the publisher of the first test copies of the Desktop Published Limited Edition, Jim Martin. I owe special thanks to Trevor Harvey, who provided additional research for this expanded edition, and, as always, to Richard Condon, who gave me early encouragement and offered his valued commentary in the mid-70s, at the beginning of my quest for the truth. Last and foremost, I am indebted to my Enid High School journalism teacher, Miss Ruth Scott, who started me on the path of citizens' intelligence so long ago. Walter H. Boward. Introduction to the Third Edition. In 1978, I lived in a beautiful handmade house at the end of Little Woody Creek outside of Aspen, Colorado. I enjoyed great friends, famous neighbors, and a beautiful environment. In the winter, I skied in the 60 acres behind my house, and in the summer, I walked along the creek to the end of the property of a road horses into national forest behind. After I returned from the world tour promoting this book, I began to get the threatening phone calls. Finally, one came which gave me concern. At 10 o'clock at night, the editor of Gallery Magazine, Eric Prater, called. "You all right?" he asked with alarm in his voice. "Yeah, why?" "I was working late in the office on deadline and I got this call. I don't know why I picked the phone up." "Yeah?" "It was a guy who said he was the sheriff of Woody Creek." "That'd be the sheriff of Pitkin County, Dick Kinst. He's a friend of mine." "I don't think that's who he was, but I didn't know. I just assumed it'd be the sheriff out where you live," he said. "I got Boward here. He says he's writing a series of articles for you on mind control and invisible warfare." "Yes, tell him. That's so." "Well, he's been shot. You want to talk to him?" I said, "Sure, put him on." "Then on comes your voice," Eric says. Right away, I noticed there's a high-pitched overtone to it that I'd never heard before. But I'd never talked to you when you were shot, so I didn't think much of it. The accent was you. It sounded like you. And what'd I say? I said. You said, Eric, I've been shot. And I said, my God, how bad are you hurt? And you said, not bad, just a flesh wound in the thigh. No problem. But if I keep writing these articles for you, they're going to keep shooting, and next time they're going to kill me. I began to get a hunch that this wasn't you. I think it was the overtone. During World War II, Eric had worked for the OSS behind the lines in Eastern Europe. He was no dummy. So I began to ask you personal questions. How's your wife and kids? I knew you were in the middle of a brutal divorce that cryptocracy was fanning with the agent who was in bed with your wife. So that's when you said, without answering, well, I gotta go. They're going to give me a shot. Talk to you in a couple days. And you got off the phone. Pretty clever, I said. I'll say, Eric said. It's definitely an intelligence call. You better lay low. I'll reject your article. Pay you a kill fee. Anytime they go to the trouble of imitating your voice, then being careful to give you a warning that is not a threat, that does not break a law. They didn't even impersonate an officer of the law. It's the cryptocracy. I was glad Eric had begun to use the word. If you say so, Eric. The next day, the warning was reinforced by paramilitary man, armed to the teeth, walking with a German shepherd towards the high ground at the back of my property. My friend and caretaker apprehended him and chased him away. He pretended to be just, quote, going for a stroll. Everything was on him, including the haircut, was government issue. This could turn into another book. After a series of death threats and legal battles and law enforcement harassment of this and other kinds, I decided that I'd take a vacation from writing in defense of democracy. Back in those days, it seemed to me that most Americans really didn't care anyway. So why should I get my head blown off? But the truth remains. It alone shall make you free. A revolt from within the ranks of the cryptocracy had already begun. Walter Board, February 14th, 2000, Paradise, Arizona. Operation Mind Control Forward by Richard Condon, author of The Manchurian Candidate. The father of a Grok the clown, having had his legs broken in 8 places by his father for professional reasons, broke Grok's legs in 8 places to be certain that the child would grow up walking grotesquely so as to ensure his eminence as a clown. The act brought much pain and indignity forever, but Grok's father reasoned. Was there not a wholly unjustifiable element involved? Was not the clowning tradition immortally enhanced by those unnatural legs? As demonstrated inescapably by Walter H. Board in this book, our father who art in the American secret police has endowed hundreds of scientists at American universities to unravel methods for fracturing American minds. That's this research in so many great halls of learning has exceeded a cost of untold secret millions of dollars, the only yardstick remaining by which we are willing to measure anything, indicates that this Grokian entertainment being produced by our secret police is a matter of ambitious policy rather than the happenings of cloak and dagger adventure. In this book, Walter H. Board has proven each step of this official terminal government anarchy, even though that appears to be a contradiction in terms. To alter and control human minds is the ultimate anarchy. What is offered by official apologists as a tribute to the deeds of daring due by romantic spies or acts of hatred and sadism against all people in an insane and degraded determination to extirpate consciousness from society. Walter H. Board underwent a long and expensive process to assemble the hard facts which compromise this book. Each document attesting to secret police intent had to be ferreted out of government archives by badgering persistence until page by page, the information was released by him by his right under the Freedom of Information Act. The essence of that law seems to be that one only right away to a federal agency for information about the general areas in which the citizen is interested. Not so. Walter H. Barrett needed to expand large sums of money to employ researchers in Washington and elsewhere in order to discover the precise name, number, and description of the contents of each document towards which he was groping through black streams of information darkness. Without this, it would have been impossible to apply for the transfer of copies of these documents to himself for this book. He had to comb the United States for people from many walks of life who knew, vaguely remembered, or suspected that they had been under the mind control of secret police and military agencies, then had to backtrack again with information gleaned from them to labyrinth research into hundreds of thousands of federal archives. Please keep fearfully in mind that the astonishing information published in this seminal work of investigative reporting concerning avenues taken decision and execution by our secret police to fracture or dissolve human minds, then to operate a yo-yo for purposes of counterintelligence military, quote, efficiency, and the destruction of democratic institutions was drawn directly from federal records and from official laboratory archives of the highest educational purposes, as well as from the reviving memories of those who had already undergone the dehumanizing process. The prostitution of the mind by our secret police preceded the murder of the mind. To attain the advanced techniques now available to, quote, magnetic and attractive political personalities, it was necessary to turn out the laboratories of science as a pimp turns out his heartless horrors upon the winter streets. Our hallowed educators, Army and Navy, Air Force commanders and personnel, the beloved medical profession, august and inspiring temples of the law, our esteemed statesmen, and all Americans living and dead. Each of those groups is involved in this dismembering of the mind. Taxes and the collective conscience make the urination of the secret police upon the human mind possible. Brainwashing, per se, is no news to any of us. Controlled assassins are not known to us only through fiction. Advertising assaults on behalf of poisonous materials to induce us sexually to buy and consume are early on bastions of mind control. No one, not anyone, needs theologians to answer the question, where does the soul live? We know the soul lives in the mind because the soul is the mind in all of its unfathomably intricate individual conditioning. It is the mind of intent, of hope, of purpose, of achievement by the spirit beyond achievement by physical action. When Croc's father broke his son's legs in 8 places, there may have been cause for alarm. On the one hand, that a man could do such a caltrumous thing to his son, but on the other, the same people responded to Grok's genius to which those hopelessly deformed legs had contributed and roared with laughter. That was the normal reaction when we were the audience and Crazy Legs Grok was the clown. But Walter Bowert demonstrates to us in this book that we have become Grok. We are the spinning, hobbling, waddling clowns in the eyes of our vividly delineated secret police. Oh, no. Can you hear the outcry? Oh, yes, writes Walter H. Bowert in this fearful record you now hold in your hands. Apologists rush in, hired for all such occasions from everywhere, by the secret government crying out, quote, you are, as usual, like all of your exaggerating kind, making a mountain out of a molehill. While it may or may not be true that our secret police occasionally swing the sledgehammer on the little mines, it is, or is not, being done as a patriotic act to protect our beloved people. They reel backward, hands clutching chests, as the full realization seems to hit them. My God, Bowert cannot believe that our government, of the people, by the people, and for the people would use such loathsome forces against citizens. If such research was done, or was not done, then it would be for purely abstract research reasons, for expansions of human knowledge. Walter H. Bowert's book is also a freezing vision of the mutations of the aspirations of science. Scientists, educators, and their leaders, the great men, having stumbled upon the possibility of controlling the human mind, might well have withheld this knowledge from the secret police and brought it forward for all to share. Would you not say? If the means are at hand, actually, to enter and control the mind, not through far-off smoke signals of psychiatry and psychoanalysis, can we conceive of what might be found in terms of medical triumphs, the conquest of pain and of group hatreds, and mental energy released by unraveling the garden knots of mental perplexity to make one straight laser line that might pierce through the doubts and fears which beset each one of us? In terms of education, light years ahead of educational means we presumably employ in basic and advanced culture, languages, and skills, in short, understanding of each other's across the face of the world, this development of mind control makes the invention of movable type seem like a primordial grunt from the shadows of a rainforest lost in time. What has been achieved by the secret police in relation to mind control is scrupulously set down in Walter Bowert's extraordinary book. The question the book puts is this: do you wish the immeasurably important technique to remain as a weapon to be used against you and your children by what Bowert calls the cryptocracy? Or do you wish to use it as a universal key to unlock 1,000 new chances that your children will not be murdered in future wars? In an epigraph to this book, Zbigniew Brzezinski measures the political probabilities of mind control use when he says, quote, "Exploiting the latest communication techniques to manipulate emotion and control reason. Today, our secret police and our military establishments have demonstrated in Vietnam and elsewhere, examined by Bowert herein, the powers to create assassins out of our children. The expansion of these powers, which are able to turn young men and women into murderous criminals at will, goes on unchecked by oft-called investigative press, by moral leaders at the bar, in the pulpits, in high government, and on campuses. Yet the people they call the public have long suspected that it become government policy to control minds. If there's a general information abroad on this subject, then consider that which be at the disposal of congressional investigating committees as they boogle their determination to control the powers of darkness within our secret police. Zombie is a quaint, old-fashioned folklore word which, by its meaning, becomes obscene when our children's minds are being controlled by any one of the dozens of federal secret police agencies. Have government agencies perfected methods sustained by the taxpayers to control the minds of the people who shot Kennedy's Martin Luther King and Orlando Leitler, the former Chilean economist and diplomat? Were the assassins programmed to forget they did, or were they programmed to do it? We may never know, for they stand bewildered, idiotically grinning for the cameras. Have the technicians developed a model giant, economy-sized government assassin which can be easily turned out by the thousands? The murders of a few hundred humans by a few hundred other humans is commonplace enough, but for the favor of horror and terror, of endless nightmare rampant upon a landscape of what was once American democracy. Consider this expansion of the Brzezinski epigraph, which cannot be repeated often enough. Quote, "In the tectonic society, the trend would seem to be toward the aggregation of the individual support of millions of uncoordinated citizens, easily within the reach of magnetic and attractive personalities, effectively exploiting the latest communication techniques to manipulate emotion and control reason." End quote. The threatening state of American political leadership over the last 15 years may seem to murmur that the, quote, "magnetic and attractive personalities," end quote, might rather not resist the destruction of democratic institutions by, quote, "effectively exploiting," end quote, these shocking gains into the control of minds. It might even be wise to consider Walter Bowert's real evidence herein, then do what we can to protect ourselves if that proud right with a love of freedom has not been atrophied by the, quote, "latest communication techniques." There is an alternative. We call all forevermore be transformed into an image of the Grok the Clown. Richard Condon, Kilmargony, Ireland, 31st of May, 1977. Chapter 1, The Kryptonian Candidate. It may have been the biggest story since the atomic bomb. The headline, however, was small and ignored the larger issue. Drug tests by CIA held more extensive than reported in 75, said the New York Times in July 16, 1977. What it should have said is, quote, U.S. develops invisible weapons to enslave mankind. The testing of drugs by the CIA was just a part of the United States government's top-secret mind control project, a project that had spanned 35 years and had involved tens of thousands of individuals. It involved techniques of hypnosis, narcohypnosis, electronic brain stimulation, behavioral effects of ultrasonic, microwave, and low-frequency sound, aversive and other behavioral modification therapies. In fact, there was virtually no aspect of human behavioral control that was not explored in their search for the means to control the memory and will of both individuals and whole masses of people. The CIA and the Pentagon succeeded in developing a whole range of psycho weapons to expand its already ominous psychological warfare arsenal. With these capabilities, it was now possible to wage a new kind of war, a war that could take place invisibly upon the battlefield of the human mind. Literature always anticipates life, said Oscar Wilde. It does not copy it, but molds it to its purpose. By Wilde's definition, then Richard Condon's The Manchurian Candidate would appear to be literature. Condon published his tour de force in 1958. It was the story of an American Army sergeant who was captured by the enemy during the Korean conflict and, in an improbable 9 days, was hypno-programmed to murder an NQ. The sergeant returned to the United States and was post-hypnotically triggered to kill by sight of the Queen of Diamonds in a deck of cards. The sergeant automatically killed several people, among them a candidate for President of the United States. After he killed him, his memory of the event was forever sealed by amnesia. At the time, The Manchurian Candidate was published, few people in the world, Richard Condon included, knew the total control of the mind was possible. Condon was writing fiction. He had merely read up on a popular Pavlovian conditioning manual and imagined the rest. He had no way of knowing that the mind control had already been the subject of years of secret research within the clandestine agencies of the U.S. government. The tricks of mind control he described were employed right down to the Queen of Diamonds cue by the programmers of the real political assassins who developed foolproof techniques for the control of thought, memory, emotions, and behavior. The Manchurian Candidate brought the idea of brainwashing to public consciousness. Brainwashing is the use of isolation, deprivation, torture, and indoctrination to break the human will. But what the book actually described was something more than brainwashing. It was mind control, a total takeover of someone's individual mind by someone else. The someone else, in Condon's version, was a mad Chinese psycho-scientist. Always the satirist, Condon brought the Fu Manchu myth up to date, but ironically, the techniques he described were first perfected and used by the Chinese or the communists, but by the United States. Condon's portrait of POWs during the Korean conflict went against the accepted scientific and medical opinion of the time, which held that a man could not be made to commit a criminal act against his own will or inner moral code by any known means. Although Condon's book was not completely on target about the details of GI mind control, he did accurately describe some of the motives, coercive methodology, and psychological results of real-life mind control. The psychological techniques described in The Manchurian Candidate had secretly become a reality a decade before Condon saw the story set in type. A decade later, it appeared as if Condon's fiction had been used as the blueprint for the creation of an army of hypno-programmed zombies. Some were assassins prepared to kill on cue. Others were informers, made to remember minute details under hypnosis. Couriers carried illegal messages outside the chain of command, their secrets secured behind post-hypnotic blocks. Knowledge of secret information was removed from the minds of those who no longer had the, quote, need to know. They were given post-hypnotic amnesia. The fact is, induced amnesia had been used at least since World War II. In the Journal of Traumatic Stress, we find the story of a World War II veteran who had been discharged from the service in 1947. According to Karen L. Cassidy and Judith Linens, the veteran had been treated at the VA hospital for post-traumatic stress disorder since the war and enjoyed good health and a lasting relationship until he had his first cardiovascular accident, known in layman's terms as a stroke. Then he began to recall the memories of his intelligence service in the Pacific Theater during the Second World War. In 1988, he suffered two CVAs that resulted in right side weakness, speech difficulties, loss of motor control, and disorientation to situation, time, and place. These symptoms gradually resolved and he was able to resume psychotherapy in 1989. During therapy, he began to recall combat memories and details of his service as an intelligence officer for which he had previously been amnesic. According to the journal, he particularly recalled being captured and tortured by administration of intravenous hallucinogens. He also recalled being bayoneted in the right side during hand-to-hand combat, thus explaining the scar previously noted. Newly recalled memories depicted the content of many of his nightmares and disassociative episodes. He recalled his escape and military debriefing in which he underwent hypnotic procedures to help him forget his combat experiences. Although his recall of these procedures is sketchy, he remembers that these hypnotic sessions occurred almost daily for several weeks, during which time he was also given medications. These procedures focus upon helping him develop an identity and personal history that excluded intelligence service and traumatic events. Additionally, while hospitalized, he had a flashback in which he mistook intravenous apparitions for being bayoneted. An Asian physician observed him speaking on Asian dialect during his flashback. Collectively, this data led to us to conclude that military events occurred and reported and cannot be dismissed as delusions and fabrications. The authors noted that in this man's case, it appears that amnesia for traumatic memories was disinhibited. His case indicated that cognitive impairment, such as that due to declining health and aging, may also impair previously successful defenses and lead to delayed PTSD. Those who led us to believe that the intelligence agencies were searching for a Manchurian candidate have to go back and rewrite their false assumptions. The fact came well before the fiction. Michael Crichton, a Harvard-educated MD who served at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California, and went on to write several screenplays, one which fetched a record $10 million advance, wrote The Terminal Man while he was shooting his first film, The Andromeda Strain, in 1971. 7 years before Operation Mind Control was published, Crichton's novel was the first in the modern era to have the words Mind Control printed boldly on the back cover. Crichton explained these typical blindsided attitude of his first profession and the public who welcomed his early work so warmly in his introduction to The Terminal Man. Quote, "Readers who find the subject matter of this book shocking or frightening should not delude themselves by also thinking it is something quite new. The physical study of the brain has been proceeding for more than a century. The technology of behavior modification has been developing for more than 50 years. For decades, if there was anyone to see, discuss, or support, or oppose. Nor has there been any lack of publicity. Research in neurobiology is spectacular enough to appear regularly in the Sunday supplements, but the public has never really taken it seriously. There has been so much ominous talk and so much frivolous speculation for so many years that the public now regards mind control as a problem removed to the distant future. It might eventually happen, but not soon, and not in a way that would affect anyone now alive. Scientists engaged in this research have sought public discussion. James V. McConnell of the University of Michigan told his students some years ago, "Look, we can do these things, we can control our behavior. Now who's going to decide what's to be done? If you don't get busy and tell me how I'm supposed to do it, I'll make up my own mind for you, and then it's too late." in the theme he would repeat after in a timeline as a novel published in 2000, based in part on research in quantum physics, Crichton continued. Many people today feel that they live in a world that is predetermined and running along a fixed pre-established course. Past decisions have left us with pollution, depersonalization, and urban blight. Somebody else who made the decisions for us, and we are stuck with the consequences. That attitude represents a childish and dangerous denial of responsibility, and everyone should recognize it for what it is. Most of the ordinary foot soldiers that fought in the dirty televised Vietnam conflict were released to civilian life without debriefing. For them, there was no decompression from the rage of war. They were released with all the reflexes of trained assassins intact. Those who had been conditioned in the black science of the war of torture, terror, and technology were debriefed with special attention. Their memories, like those of World War II veteran mentioned in the Journal of Traumatic Stress, were completely erased before they turned out the military that they returned to civilian life with only the minimum fragmented knowledge of who they were or what they had done. Their memories had been smudged or removed by drugs, hypnosis, behavior modification, conditioned reflex therapy, or some other evil wonder of mind control. During my 1978 tour promoting this book, a call came to the KPX-TV Good Morning San Francisco show while we were on the air. It was a retired Navy commander who spoke of losing his memory after being admitted to a Navy hospital after a lengthy tour of duty, which he and his black pajama team had assassinated charismatic local political leaders behind a fixed border in Southeast Asia. In a private phone conversation later, the commander told me that fixed border was indeed that of China. I got the flu. Almost everybody on the returning team got this heavy flu. We went to the hospital and came out with cardboard memories. He said, "It had taken me 13 years to remember what we had been doing. I'm not proud of it, and I'm afraid to talk." I encountered my first case of mind control in the midst of the Watergate scandal. A young man I'd known since childhood had returned from the tour of duty in the U.S. Air Force with amnesia, remembering nothing of his service except having a good time. He subsequently learned through intensive private psychotherapy that he'd been hypnotized and conditioned. His mind had been unmade, then remade. His mind had been controlled. I was completely fascinated by his story, but naturally in 1973, I thought it was an isolated, single event. Then, quite by accident, a few months later, I overheard another man in my hometown telling me what essentially was the same story. How he figured he'd been hypnotized and his memory erased at the debriefing prior to his separation from military service. After hearing the second story, I began to wonder how many more men had their memories erased. I decided to run the following classified ad. Researcher, writer, interested in contacting anyone with knowledge or use of hypnosis by the military, including ex-servicemen who have reason to believe they are hypnotized or drugged while in service and subsequently exhibited signs of amnesia or hyperamnesia, improved memory, all info held in strictest confidence. I placed an ad in the Soldier of Fortune magazine, which reports on the activities of mercenaries. A number of small publications aimed at hypnotists, behaviorists, neurologists, and other professionals, and popular magazines such as Rolling Stone. To my amazement, I received more than 100 replies to the ad. Many stated they had amnesia. Ignoring the obvious crank letters, I followed up on the others and discovered that too many weren't able to say just what it had caused their lack of memory. In some cases, it was obviously a result of the trauma of war, which had come to be called the post-Vietnam syndrome. So I concentrated on those who had not seen combat, who were either had high security clearances or were employed at the periphery of the intelligence services. Letter and telephone exchanges narrowed the field down to 18 persons who fit the pattern of the first two men who had reported amnesia to me. All 18 had security clearances and could only recall isolated events from their GI experience. I narrowed the field still further to those who remembered enough to have at least some idea, however fragmentary and incomplete, of what had happened to them. Their stories were believable, but they shed little light on how amnesia had been induced and what behavior had been controlled. To answer those deeper questions, I went to the libraries, and after 2 years of research, I was able to find enough scientific reports and government documents to tell the whole story of what I called Operation Mind Control. Though the documented trail of mind control extends back many decades, it was not always called by that name. The church and the state have always engaged in psychotheology and psychopolitics and psychological manipulation of belief, opinion, and actions for political and or religious ends. But the complete control of the human mind was only managed in the late 1940s by U.S. government. It had to have existed in a variety of subcultures throughout human history. My research originally concentrated on the period from 1938 to the late 60s, the period during which I found there was an effort made by the agencies of the U.S. government to develop sophisticated techniques of psychopolitics and mind control on the modern sense, I thought. The objective of Operation Mind Control during this period has been to take human beings, both citizens of the United States and citizens of friendly and unfriendly nations, and transform them into unthinking, subconsciously programmed zombies, motivated without their knowledge and against their wills to perform a variety of ways in which they could not otherwise willingly perform. I learned that this is accomplished through the use of a number of various techniques, most of which amount to pain and trauma-based classical conditioning. Mind control is the most terrible imaginable crime because it is committed not against the body, but against the mind and the soul. Dr. Joost A.M. Mierlo expresses the attitude of the majority of psychologists calling it mind rape and warns that it proposes a great danger to total physical destruction. Development of mind control was accomplished largely through efforts of individual psychologists, psychiatrists, and chemists working in isolated conditions under government contract. Each researcher or research team was allowed to know only what he or she needed to know to accomplish his or her fragment of the research or testing. The contracts were let through a number of government and private agencies and foundations, so the researchers were, by and large, ignorant as to the intended use of their research. While the CIA was a major funder of the mind control research, virtually every major government agency became in some way, knowingly or unwittingly, involved. While I began my research believing that a cult of intelligence was behind mind control programming, I found that there is, in fact, no single originating force, but several. The operation is too widespread and complex for it to be created by a cult. If a cult there must be, then is a cult within a cult, an interlocking chain of invisible mini-governments with unwritten rules, unwritten plans, and unwritten loyalties. It is the plan of a secret bureaucracy, what I call the cryptocracy, which conspires against our laws and our freedoms. Cryptocracy is a compound of crypto, meaning secret, and across and crazy, which means rule, government, and government body. The cryptocracy then, in the secret government, whose identity and whereabouts have slowly and reluctantly been hinted at by the Congress through its investigation in Watergate, the CIA, and the rest of the intelligence community. The word cryptocracy is conspicuously absent from all dictionaries, even to this day. I was told by one source within the cryptocracy that this word alone was reason enough to keep this book off the market, for if, whenever the word democracy is used, the word cryptocracy is placed against it, a powerful propaganda effect takes place, as if one word alone could awaken the U.S. citizenry to the fact that the democracy was overthrown by the National Security Act of 1947. While the CIA, near the top of the intelligence pyramid, has been drawing most of the fire, the evidence of the cryptocracy clearly implicates the National Security Agency, the National Programs Office, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and its subsidiaries in military intelligence, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as well as civil service. The Crypto Alliance has extended in an ever-expanding network among private contractors and institutions and religious organizations. With the Central Intelligence in the vanguard, the cryptocracy is composed of persons operating within the Office of Naval Intelligence, Army Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, Department of Justice, Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, Bureau of Prisons, Bureau of Narcotics, Atomic Energy Commission, Department of Energy, Veterans Administration, General Services Administration, National Science Foundation, and even American major corporations, especially certain airlines, oil companies, and aerospace contractors. The cryptocracy invades the privacy of citizens and corporations. It meddles often violently in the internal politics of foreign nations and has hired, trained, and equipped mind control assassins for the murder of heads of state. The cryptocracy may have been involved in attempts to control U.S. elections. It controls key figures in the U.S. and world press. When CIA Director Robert M. Gates publicly promised a greater openness and sense of public responsibility at the intelligence agency in April of 1992, he was acting on the recommendations of a special task force that had studied ways to make the agency more visible, credible, and responsible to the outside world. But when Task Force report on greater CIA openness was submitted to Gates, it was stamped secret. CIA officials refused to disclose any of the report. After receiving public scolding at the House of Hearings, Gates approved the declassification of almost the entire report. Significantly, the report touted the accomplishments of the agency's existing, quote, media program. The Public Affairs Office of the CIA now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation. This has helped us turn some intelligence failure stories into intelligence success stories, and it has contributed to the accuracy of countless others. In many instances, we have persuaded reporters to postpone, change, hold, or even scrap stories that could have adversely affected national security interests or jeopardized sources and methods. The story within the story is an astonishing one of psychological war waged by cryptocracy against the American people. The scientific report and histories place the story in time at the government's door. However, the literature of the cryptocracy ignores the very real human factor. There is no written record of the mental anguish, the torture to the soul that comes from the loss of memory, and the resulting identity crisis. That mental anguish is the story of mind control. The stories that follow are all told by the failures of Operation Mind Control. Failures because the victims remember something, for where mind control is successful, there is no memory left. Due to editorial considerations, many of the stories I uncovered have been left on the editing room floor. Each individual in this book stands for and tells the story of many victims of mind control. In many cases, the individuals I interviewed believe their lives or sanity would be in danger if their names were made public. Others wanted their names mentioned. I have, for a variety of reasons, chosen to withhold real names and places whether requested or not. Except in these details, the first-person stories in this book are completely true. And in this edition, I have risked committing the literary crime of redundancy so that this researcher can get a more well-rounded sense of the varieties of the mind control experiences as described by several individuals. One of the characters of the Manchurian Candidate described his recurring dream that resulted from the suppression of memory. "It's not so much that I can't sleep. It's more that I'd rather not sleep. I'm walking around punchy because I'm scared. I keep having the same nightmare." The nightmare Condon's hero described was actually the memory of having killed on cue. On stage, before an audience of communist mind controllers, he strangled one of his fellow soldiers with a scarf and blew out another's brains with a high-powered pistol at point-blank range. Several of the men I interviewed had dreams that would have been written by Condon. Tex was an army sergeant stationed in the Mediterranean area. He came back from a service with amnesia, but in his dreams a vivid scene was replaced again and again. In the dream, my buddy, I knew him real well, we've shared things together, but he was taken with his hands behind his back. I'm standing in rank and line of other soldiers and we were like a firing squad. I keep thinking, I won't shoot my friend, I'll turn the rifle on the commander, but we don't have rifles. My buddy has marched into an open area in front of us with his hands tied behind his back. He's blindfolded and some Arab is talking to him and reading to him. Another Arab comes up and hits him behind the knees with a rifle butt and he falls into a kneeling position. Then, while he's on his knees, one of the Arabs takes a big sword and cuts his head off. His neck squirts blood, but surprisingly little. His head rolls on the ground. His face has a peaceful expression. His body twitches and squirms like a chicken. That's when I always wake up. In their sleep, the memories of atrocities surface to vivid awareness among the victims of mind control. Night after night, terrible images suppressed by deeply conditioned responses emerge as terrifying nightmares. Are they mythological, the stuff of dreams, or are they recovered memories? Texas' dream is a mere fragment of many thousand pages of testimony.